This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest this afternoon on Keeping the Faith is joining us by phone from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Can you hear me all right, Jeannie? Hello, Jeannie. Are you there?
I am.
Good. We're talking with a professor from the University of Delaware who lives in Philadelphia, Jeannie Murray Walker. She's a poet and a playwright. And today we're going to be talking about, among other things, can a poet retire? I don't know why that's on my mind since my retirement date has been announced, but I thought it'd be fun to talk about a poet about this issue. Jeannie, you're just back from London. What were you doing there?
I was teaching students. I was teaching 20 students a course in British culture, and also I taught a course in theater, which was great fun. It's a wonderful theater season. So if any of your listeners can get to London, this winter season is absolutely terrific.
What are some of the great plays there at the moment?
Well, there is a wonderful Homecoming, The Homecoming by Harold Pinter,
sure,
which is at the Almeida Theater. It was just opening as we left. There is a good new play at the National Theater called Happy Now, and there was a wonderful Much Ado About Nothing. It's kind of hard to get tickets, but it might be held over, and there's a possibility of getting tickets that way. There's another play, which is called The War Horse, which is a fabulous spectacle. It's done with puppets. And there are three guys in each horse. There are a bunch of horses on stage. And they are incredibly real, so that you feel enormous empathy for these horses. It's not much of a script, but it's a great spectacle.
Now tell us about before we get to poetry, tell us about your work as a playwright.
Well, I've just come back, actually, from Boston, where I was working with a theater on a new script. And it's terribly exciting. The script is read aloud, and you really don't know what's going to happen or how good it is till you hear it. I think most playwrights really need to hear a script read aloud. So the next stage after that reading is to go back and revise it, and then this theater will probably do it. So,
does this play have a title yet?
It's called To Bottle Lightning.
To Bottle Lightning.
That's it.
All right. Well, let's switch from talking about being a playwright to talk about being a poet. You've been on this program once before. Good to have you back.
Right, thanks.
And you've had several poems published since we last had you on the air. One just a week or so ago came out in the Christian Century magazine called Self-Examination. And I think, with your permission, I'll read that. It's a short poem, about 14 lines, I'd say, maybe 100 words. May I read it?
Absolutely.
You want to give us a little intro to it before, or shall I just say your words?
Well, this is one of about 40 sonnets. I went back to start writing sonnets to kind of pull in the language a little bit, and it's a sort of a Lenten poem.
So, in the large Christian tradition of Lenten meditative literature, listen to Jeannie Murray Walker's Self-Examination. This is the last outrage, what women do in secret, slipping their fingers under bras or nightgowns on wild, moon-driven nights, needing to true the circle of their breasts, wanting to lunge below desire, beneath arousal, and beyond the sweet milk happiness of feeding children, to find the nuclear, god-awful contraband their bodies might be hiding, the refrain, danger, danger, singing in their minds. At dusk, I slip into a pew, enthralled, alert, combing through the week to find what might destroy me, to send it away. Lawyer, accused, bent to root out scandal, my hands judging, and also, maybe, guilty. Self-Examination, a poem by Jeannie Murray Walker. And Jeannie, I might spell your first name since it looks like it might be pronounced Jean, J-E-A-N-N-E, but your family pronounces that Jeannie. Jeannie Murray Walker is our poet and guest today. So, starting off talking about the possibility of finding cancer, that's a scary thing to so many people these days.
Well, it is, and it's a metaphor, I think, for the kind of self-examination. It's a life or death issue, you know, that you carry on at some level, I think, especially after you get to be a little older and kind of thinking a little bit more in final terms. But it seemed like a good metaphor to me.
So do poems have to have metaphor?
I don't know. I just finished reading a book by Steven Pinker, who's a philosopher, and who makes the argument that that's how we think. We think by using metaphor, and there's no way of getting around it. So I don't know whether we need to have metaphor. Maybe it's just that we don't need to point it out so obviously.
And some philosophers have talked about all language being at root metaphoric.
Yeah, and I think that's the way you know, a lot of us think. It's pretty hard to think really directly and logically, and we kind of zigzag around. But that's for sure what the life of a poem seems to go in and out of metaphor.
Let our listeners hear your voice reading one of your poems. I jealously wanted to start with that one myself, but what have you selected for us to hear?
Well, I thought I would read a poem called Dinner Party, and this is just about a time when we got together with some friends who were over here for dinner, and it's about, I think, the poverty of everyday language. It's about the way it's almost impossible to talk about those moments of communion when time seems to stop and you seem really connected with one another. What do you say afterwards? What you say is, it was fun. You know, there's not really much else to say because it's so hard to find a way to talk about these kinds of experiences in everyday language, which is part of the reason I think we need poetry. So this poem is called Dinner Party. We lounge amid the wreckage of this lovely evening, next to little pelts of scooped-out cantaloupe on blue Spanish plates, while Billie Holiday drifts through us like fog through trees. We have almost made it together inside loneliness, almost reached that perfect shadowy place where it doesn't matter what we say, the others grasp it. We are chords in a new progression into stillness, a new rendition of all of me, though none of us, if asked, could tell what taught us such love was possible. And then suddenly we're back in history, as if a gust of gravity had swept in, or the rubber band snapped. And we're pulling on our coats, reaching for polite goodbye phrases like rain hats, remembering there's happiness at home, too, and a posturpedic mattress and a dog to walk. We look plain again, standing around like extras in a movie. What happened among us may be true and secret. It may be everything. But the night won't talk, and none of us can find the word to loosen its tongue. It was fun, we say later. It was fun.
Dinner Party, a poem written and read by Jeannie Murray Walker. Jeannie, that's been collected in one of your books, so tell us the title.
The title of the book is A Deed to the Light, and it's published by the University of Illinois Press.
I've heard of it.
Right.
You've had a varied publishing history, like many contemporary poets. There are university presses that publish poetry. There are some trade publishers that do poetry, often knowing that in advance this will lose money. Why do publishers still publish poems when there are so few readers who seem to be willing to buy the books?
I think that's a good question. One of the answers to that is that more people are buying books. There are poetry festivals around, more people reading poetry. There are websites, Verse Daily and Poetry Daily and Garrison Keillor's Almanac, and I think more people are actually buying books of poetry, so it's not quite the risk it was 10 or 12 years ago. But I think some editors feel that we need poetry, and that they're willing to take a loss on that line, and they try to make it up somewhere else, which is a wonderful thing because, you know, for one thing, I depend on it to be able to read myself and to teach to my students. But I think we just need poetry. Humans need a little reflection. So anyway, it's a good thing that they do it.
How many books of poetry have you had published at this point in your career?
6, and I have a 7th coming out this summer.
Who's publishing that?
It'll be published by Erdmans.
And what's the title?
Well, we don't know yet what the title is. We're struggling over the title. But it'll come out from Erdmans, hopefully, towards the end of the summer.
Is it a collection from your recent writings? Is it more of a retrospective?
No, it's not a book of collected poems. It's all poems that have not been published before, except in journals. The life of a poem is to go to a journal first, like the one you just read from Christian Century, and then we collect those poems, 70 of them or so, and put them in a book. So these poems have been published in journals, almost all of them, but none of them have been in a book yet.
Now, your poems are perhaps unusual in that they are published both in academic journals, in religious journals, in literary journals. How unusual is that?
I think it's less and less unusual. And I'm not sure why, but I have had no trouble getting, you know, crossing that line at all, ever. And I've been writing for 25 years. I think that editors of literary journals, journals like Poetry Magazine and Prairie Schooner and Shenandoah and the Gettysburg Review, are keenly aware that spiritual needs or understandings or insights are human ones, you know, and they're pretty interested in the quality of a poem rather than the subject. Occasionally there are journals that are thematically set up, but a lot of times I think most editors' descriptions of what they publish in journals is we take good poetry and then they kind of leave it to you to figure out what that means. And it means something slightly different for each editor, but the way to find out is by reading the journal, and you catch on pretty fast. But I think that most good journals are quite happy to have poetry that talks about spiritual life and the spiritual journey. It's a question of quality.
Let's talk a little bit about quality. Religious publications have not been known for selecting the best kind of poetry to publish. Much of it's been pretty bad. Has that been a risk for you as a professional poet who's also a professor and playwright to risk having your poems published in places that might publish dreck?
Well, you know, there are a lot of places that publish, a lot of religious publications that publish good stuff. Now, I think they don't have to publish bad stuff. There's so much good around that they can take their pick of the good stuff. So it hasn't been a problem for me. And I know that poetry that's supposed to be Christian poetry, if that's really the point of it, to argue dogma, it's probably not even poetry. It's not even bad poetry. It may not be poetry at all. So I know what you're talking about, but I think that there are a lot of places that publish on a religious theme. The whole journal is about spirituality or religious issues, and it's pretty good what they publish.
And the Christian Century that you've been published in a lot over your career is certainly one of the better ones and has had a number of very perceptive editors, poetry editors, who have made good choices. Tell us some of the other places that you've been published in journals and magazines that have religious concerns and interests.
Well, there's a wonderful journal from Valparaiso called The Crescent, which publishes, you know, the kind of poets who would be in Poetry Magazine, who are in Poetry Magazine. That's a terrific magazine. It has interesting nonfiction prose as well. Image is
relatively new.
Yeah, it's been around
10 years, maybe.
Yeah, I think they just had their 10th anniversary. It's a journal of art and faith and mystery, and it's a beautiful magazine. In addition to being really interesting, having interesting essays, interesting fiction,
and interesting visual art, which is unusual.
Yeah. Absolutely. Greg's grandfather was an artist, and he's very committed to visual art. So,
the editor, Gregory Wolf?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those are some.
Now, you've also been published in poetry. You've also been published in some fairly exclusive literary magazines. Tell us about some of those.
Well, I have a long history with Poetry Magazine. Actually, one of the editors, John Frederick Nims, was my mentor from the time I was 19 years old. I met him at Breadloaf School of English, where he was teaching. And Joe Parisi, who was the next editor, published a lot of my work, and Chris Wyman, who's editor now, has published my work. So, yeah, I have a long history going back with Poetry Magazine, long history with Prairie Schooner, which is in Lincoln, Nebraska, started by Carl Shapiro, and Hilda Raz is the editor now, and it's just a fabulous, fabulous journal for poetry. They take risks. They do really interesting poetry from a wide range of different styles, including lots of newcomers and young poets, and I love it. So Those are two places. In Shenandoah, I'm on the editorial board at Shenandoah. The Gettysburg Review, which is a wonderful journal. The Kenyon Review and the Georgia Review. A number of different periodicals that I think are just splendid. We have a lot of good small journals in this country.
Let me encourage listeners who might have a question for our guest today, the poet and playwright Jeannie Murray Walker. Do give us a call. This is a live program every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580 from 5 to 6 p.m. If you'd like to call, anywhere you can hear this program, there's a toll-free number, including if you're listening on the Internet, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, you can get several local lines by punching in 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana environs, 333-9455. And I suppose anytime you have a chance to talk to a published poet and dramatist, sort of any questions would be welcome, like how to get started, if you're curious about that. I may ask about that a little bit later in the program. But let's hear another poem, Jeannie. You started off with a sonnet, a very traditional English form. Then you did something, I didn't have it before me, but I'm guessing it was free verse?
It was, yeah.
From your most recent book, A Deed to the Light. And read another one for us.
Okay, let me put on my glasses here. This poem is called To My Son Off to College. I think that moment when it comes time to open the door and you've got the suitcases and you know that you're gonna take the kid to the airport or drive off to the school and drop him off and he never really comes back in the same way again. And it's a moment that so many of us have experienced. And the kids experience it, but not from the same point of view. So this is called To My Son Off to College. We stand there in our vestibule, me clutching my car keys, you, your suitcase. Me about to recite the names of apples, Winesap, Braeburn, etc., the way poets recite them. Then to chant the names of poets, too. Anything you'll listen to. Stanzas of lightning from red mouths. It isn't loveliness I'm after, I can tell you. It's any damn thing that keeps your hand from pushing that door open, though you're long gone already. And I know it's wrong when the heart has stopped to pretend it hasn't. Like a taxidermist. No, we're mixed up with time, my love, and poetry, as usual, fails to stop you. You have to go away, and you may not be back. I eat one of the apples in your memory, like a pioneer who's down to eating seed corn, the sweet sour juices running into a future without you. Well, a voice tells me I don't own you, you were a gift. And my barbaric, unteachable mother heart doesn't get it. Thinks, okay, fine, so you're gone now. You're that much closer to coming back.
To My Son Off to College, also from the collection published by University of Illinois Press, A Deed to the Light, poem written and read by Jeannie Murray Walker here on Keeping the Faith. We're getting close to halfway through our program. Let me take just a moment to let listeners know what's coming up in future weeks. Claire Butterfield will be our guest next week on February 24th, talking about Faith in Place, an organization that deals with religious issues as they confront important societal issues such as environmental concerns. She'll be talking with us by phone from Chicago. On March 2nd, we have something that we're looking forward to. It's a little bit unusual. We'll be talking with a young woman who just graduated from college, and she may be one of the most well-known college students in America, although people don't know her real name usually. She goes by the name on YouTube of Kaisie, K-I-C-E-S-I-E. And she talks about advanced sex education, mainly for young people. She herself has come through a sexual assault and talks about it. She is currently in graduate school learning how to be a sex therapist. So there are literally millions of people who have seen her videos on YouTube, and she's going to be here on the radio with us live on March 2nd by phone. Coming up March 9th, another unusual program for Keeping the Faith, although we've done it once before. We'll be talking with someone in the West Bank of Israel, in the Palestinian territories, Pastor John Setterland. We'll be talking with him about the whole theme of Christians in Palestine today. He's a Lutheran pastor. He's been there over a year, and we'll be talking with him by phone live, although he'll have to stay up into the middle of the night to talk with us live on March 6th. The Intercultural Friendship Foundation, a Muslim group here at the University of Illinois, will be our guests talking about some issues facing Islam on March 16. March 23rd, we'll be talking with Mike Polito about the Red Bison Prairie Restoration Group, a very environmentally conscious group here at the University of Illinois. And then March 30th, we have a special guest talking about the secular and religious divide in Israel. An Israeli guest will be on our program. So those are some of the people we'll be talking with, some of the issues. Hope you as listeners can join us, and we'll call with comments or questions. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, although Don Nolan fills in quite ably often when I'm unable to be here. I'm the director of the University YMCA, which is the oldest continuous student organization at the university. The Y is a very active place. Our guest today by phone, when she was on one of her book tours, did give a poetry reading there a while back. Just this afternoon, we had a fascinating program on the folly of attacking Iran at the Y with Stephen Kinzer, a former New York Times correspondent and the author of All the Shah's Men and Overthrow. The Y is a very active place. Next week coming up are two lecture series that are open to the public. On Tuesday noon, part of the Know Your University series, we have at least one student from the Iraq Veterans Against the War from this Central Illinois chapter. Jason Wallace will be with us, and perhaps others. A student veterans call for peace. These are people who are young folks who were soldiers in Iraq and who now believe that the war needs to come to an end. That'll be this Tuesday at noon at the University Y, 1001 South Ride, a free talk. You can get a lunch from our Y Thai restaurant, or you can bring your own lunch or simply come and hear the free lecture. Friday at noon, another lecture, part of the Friday Forum series that's been going on at this Y for over 80 years. This year, the whole theme for our 10 speakers is Unraveling Spin. Kathleen Robbins will be our guest this Friday noon. She's been helping rebuild the Haitian economy, and we'll be talking about issues of microfinance and appropriate technology in the developing world, creating opportunity through appropriate technology, Kathleen Robbins, at the Y this Friday at noon. If you want to reserve a lunch, you can call 337-1500. University Y is on the corner of Wright and Chalmers, right on the quadrangle. It's often hard to find parking, we know, but the buses come by many times an hour from all over this Champaign-Urbana. Even people from out of town can park in the free parking outside the campus area and then take a bus for a buck and get right to the Y. Also around noon on Friday, many students are taken off, so there often are parking spaces if people can brave the construction zone which is surrounding the Y right now. Incidentally, the Y needs to thank many people who contributed to our capital campaign that's helping us refurbish our wonderful 70-year-old building in that great location. So again, thanks to many people on campus and in the community and around the country who care about this particular work on this campus and who have been so generous in their financial support. One other program I need to announce very quickly, and that's the Interreligious Dialogue series that's happening at the Unitarian Universalist Church, sponsored by the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, a Muslim group mainly from Turkish students. There are four in this series. One's already happened. The next one is this Thursday, February 21st at 7 o'clock. That's at the Green Street Church, 309 West Green, Urbana, Unitarian Universalist Church, and it's a panel of people representing Jews and Christians and Muslims and people of other faiths, talking about some, in this case, the sources of faith. And if you can't come this Thursday, the 21st of February, perhaps you can come March 6th or April 3rd, also at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Church, where they'll be talking about the sources, various ways of sharing one's faith, problems with that, or potentials with that. And finally, the problem of evil on April 3rd. We talk about from perspective of many different religious traditions. So it's free, open to the public. If you have questions, call the Unitarian Church in Urbana. Well, back to our guest, Jeanie Murray Walker, playwright and poet, whose newest book will be coming out this summer, published by Erdmans, whose last book was published by University of Illinois Press, called A Deed to the Light. Jeanie, before we get to another poem, let me just talk a little bit about, in response to the one you just read, about To My Son Off to College. What is fair for a poet to write about their family?
Well, I think that's an interesting and vexing problem. You know, the question of who has rights to what material. My children have never actually talked to me about this, so it's difficult for me to know how they feel. I actually wrote one entire book called Coming into History, which was about the birth of the last child, and he knows it exists. I think, I don't know whether he pays attention to it, but you know, the question is what can you write? And it's a very difficult problem because there you can only write what you know, and I think that most of us write, intermix some kind of biography along with whatever it is we're writing, and it may be recognizable to the people who are close to us. I often don't really write biographical poems. I mean, I think this poem about Jack and going off to college is a kind of poem that almost any parent could have written, except of course the parent who is so sick of the child, the 18-year-old, that you know it's really a blessing to have to separate for a little while.
And I've heard one theory that teenagers late in adolescence purposely are as nasty as possible to make that break easier for their parents.
Yeah, well, maybe so. I think, you know, whatever it is that makes them do it, it's a blessing in a way because it's just so difficult. And I think it's difficult for a lot of them, too, But they walk off without even waving goodbye because they have this wonderful future ahead of them. So anyway, this poem is, I think, a little bit generic from that point of view. It doesn't really tell any of the details about our specific lives, and so it doesn't worry me very much. I'm a little bit more worried when I tell details that are particular, you know, more particular to the family's life, and I tend not to do that too much.
Now, if I can slip for a moment from the role of a sort of objective interviewer to that of a fan, one of my favorite books of yours is called Gaining Time from about 10 years ago. And it's a fascinating book published by Copper Beach Press of interwoven poems about an extended family at the Minnesota region and sort of the founding of America or founding of a part of America. Was that in any way autobiographical, or was that totally out from your imagination?
Well, I actually went back to Parker's Prairie, which is where a lot of the book is set. It's Parker's Prairie, Minnesota, and did some research. It's very difficult to do research in a small town. It's a town of about 900 people, and they keep things very close to their chest. We used to live there when I was a kid. That's where I was born, and my family lives there. They don't anymore, but that's where they emigrated from Sweden and Germany. And so it's a kind of fictionalized history. I got as many details as I could when I went back and did research, but I found that it was very difficult to get them to talk much. So I found out as much as I could by doing paper research and doing some interviews and asking family members. And then I winged it. I did a lot of fictionalization. Starting with the premises I was given in interviews. For example, there's a series in that book it's called the Aunt Jo Poems. And it's a series about the life of a young woman who falls in love with a guy who drove the first car into town. She was actually in my grandmother's generation. She was my grandmother's younger sister. And she left town with him. By that time, there was a kind of reverse migration from the prairie back to the East Coast. And the story follows her life. There are 17 poems that follow her life, what happened to her on the East Coast and what happened when she moved back to Parker's Prairie.
Including one of them called The Rape.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, she was. It was a dreadful story, absolutely dreadful, and I had heard it all my life. But when I tried to find out about it, what really happened, it was so dreadful. I think that people just didn't talk much, and didn't. She, by that point, was not alive anymore. She was dead, and I couldn't really find out from her, although ironically, I think she would have told me every detail. That's fictionalized, a lot of the stuff in that book, but it really is based on stuff that happened in town.
Would you mind if I read the first in that series?
Oh, not at all.
By Jeannie Murray Walker, Aunt Jo tells how she learned to love. Singing hymns on Sunday evenings while snow rubbed against the stained glass windows of the Parker's Prairie First Baptist Church, I learned Jesus was the man I really loved. He was the breathing between notes, the fever rising in my belly, the space inside the perfect circle of Ross Thompson's class ring hanging on a chain around my neck. Up in heaven, Jesus longed for us so much, I could sometimes feel him brush my fingers on the hymn book. Take my hands and let them move at the impulse of thy love, at the impulse of thy love. Ross sat by his father, their tenor soaring, Ross's shoulders working above the pew, and his left hand, where he fell into the corn shredder last summer. I loved the purple scar anyone could stare at, and the way Ross held it as still as Jesus' wounded hands. O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee, I give thee back the life I owe. All our voices joining and ascending, my soprano burning out my mean pride, my love of clothes, my jealousy, until I longed to be a living sacrifice. Aunt Jo tells how she learned to love, a poem written by Jeannie Murray Walker, our guest today. There's so many different ways to read a poem. I could have inflected that last line, until I longed to be a living sacrifice. Do poets ever hate it when somebody else reads their words and it's not the way they thought it?
Oh, no. I mean, I guess, Steve, it's because I write for the theater that I am so used to hearing other people read my work. And I have come to really be quite grateful, because there are so many different ways of doing it. You know, when I wrote my first play, I saw 9 productions. In those days, I went every time there was a production. I got on the plane and went there and saw the production. And I saw 9 different ways of doing the play, because everybody had a different way of reading every single part, and each director had a different idea of what it was, and I ended up loving it. I thought, oh, this is wonderful.
You said you've been writing for 25 years. I'm guessing you meant you've been publishing for 25 years, because didn't you start very young?
Well, I started writing when I was I was quite young. I mean, I've actually been publishing more than 25 years, too. But
and you said you were at Breadloaf Conference for Writers when you were just 19.
I was, yeah.
College student?
I was a college student. Yeah, I won the Atlantic Monthly competition in both fiction and poetry and was the Atlantic Monthly Fellow when I was 19 at Breadloaf School of English. And it was a wonderful, it was an incredible summer for me, because I met John Ciardi and I met John Frederick Nims and I met Harold Bloom and I met a whole bunch of people that I could not have imagined. I mean, I knew so little about writing and knew so little about that literary world that it was absolutely stunning. And they were wonderful to me. Actually, the writers' conference in the summer school were for people who were older, and so I was like a little mascot or something. You know, I was there long before I should have been, and they were just fabulous to me. Whatever jealousy or whatever difficulties anybody might have experienced at Breadloaf, and I know sometimes those things happen, that didn't happen to me because I was too young. So anyway, that was why I was at Breadloaf.
I want to get to a caller who I think is trying. Well, there seem to be problems with our phone lines. Our technical director will fuss with that a bit. We'll see if we can get that person on the air. But in the meantime, Jeannie, when you were at Breadloaf at such a young age, you'd won the Atlantic Monthly writing contest, college writing contest, in both poetry and fiction. Had that ever been done since or before or since?
Well, they made a rule afterwards that you couldn't do it. You couldn't win in both categories. They had an essay category, and they had fiction, and they had poetry. And it was the first time anybody had won in both categories. There were separate judges for each of
sure.
these categories, so they didn't know what the other judge panel was doing.
Quite a wonderful accomplishment. Let's go to a caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was wondering if your guest could indicate for someone who's starting out with writing plays Is there software available that you would recommend, or a book that outlines the standard procedure that most publishers will be interested in looking at? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thanks.
Well, I think the best book about writing for the theater is called Formula and Form. And I'm walking over here to my bookshelf to try to get the two writers. It's written by William Missouri Downs and Luann Wright. It's W-R-I-G-H-T. It's kind of a short book. It's a guide to writing a play, and it's really good. There aren't very many good books about how to write a play. I learned how to write for the theater really from working with directors. And I think that's what you want to do is as soon as you've got a play script, see if you can find a theater that will give it a reading. And if you can't find a theater to give it a reading, bribe your friends who are good readers and get them to come over to your house and sit in a circle and read the play through, just to sign your friends to be members of the cast. And then feed them dinner or something like that. They actually like to, I found people when I was starting out like to do this, and they talk about it afterwards. And it's kind of, they enjoy being part of the process of bringing a play to birth. Usually from hearing a reading, you can see where the pacing is off. If something's too long and boring, you cut it. Cut it down a little bit. But what you need is a theater to work with you more than you need a publisher. Publishing comes at a later stage with plays. I've had a couple of plays published. I have a, you know, publishing company. But the most important thing is to get them produced. And the first step in that process is to hear it read and cut and make revisions. In this book, Playwriting from Formula to Form will give you some ideas about, you know, how to go about moving from the book to the theater.
And how would you answer that same question if it were asked about poetry?
I'm sorry, say that again.
If the same question was about poetry, how would you answer?
Well, it's not nearly as collaborative a form. I would read a lot of poetry. I would probably, if there's one book that I would recommend, it's Western Wind. That's the title, Western Wind. And it was written by John Frederick Nims. And it's now being edited by David Mason. And it's a wonderful book about prosody, which is just the features of a poem. Rhythm, metaphor, word sounds, rhyme. So that's a great book to read, and it has a little anthology in the back, which is excellent. And
Nims also was the editor of some wonderful collections of poems by many different authors. I forget, was it Harper?
Right. Uh-huh. Yep, I think that's the publisher, although I must confess I'm not sure.
And it may be out of print. I can't promise it's still in print, although, of course, through Amazon or Half.com, people can find older editions. But Nims is certainly his own poetry. His translations, for example, of Michelangelo's poems is wonderful.
Yeah, so reading John of the Cross.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful poet.
Yeah. And a terrific teacher. I mean, he taught a lot of people in my generation.
Now, was he at Northwestern or Chicago? I forget.
He was at Chicago Circle for a long time.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now called UIC, University of Illinois Chicago.
Yeah.
John Frederick Nims.
Yeah.
Janie, we announced the topic as Can a Poet Retire? As you look ahead, is this something you see yourself continuing to do? Are you exercising physically so your mind will stay strong?
I am. I joined the gym. And, you know, people have been saying that's the key, is to get to especially do something choreographed. And I must say, it's been wonderful. I just love, getting some exercise in the morning. So, and you asked me to think about this topic, and it's something I hadn't really thought much about. But I have to say, I think it is probably not possible to retire from being a poet. I don't know. It seems like a point of view rather than a job, if you know what I mean. It's like seeing the world from the point of view of an environmentalist or something. You just don't quit caring about it. Or seeing the world from the point of view of an inventor, or seeing the world from the point of view of somebody who hates everything. You know, you just don't retire from that. And I think it's probably not going to be possible to retire from being a poet, even though, I guess, maybe, you know, the publishing business or the business of bringing out books might change a little bit. What do you think?
Well, I think it's awfully hard to predict how minds will work and how much loss of the ability to use language well goes. I mean, some poets obviously can go on wonderfully and others seem to have trouble.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to predict for any of us. As a pastor, I know visiting people as they have aged, there's such horrible variations. And I know it's being studied, and who knows what the environmental causes have been for so much more problem with things like Alzheimer's and other mental brain diseases. And who knows what we're doing to ourselves with the cell phones we hold against our heads all day, but it's just hard to predict.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. My own mother has become more silent as a result of Alzheimer's, and she got to the point of almost not being able to use language at all.
Uh-huh.
And she was very garrulous. So I know about that. I know that's absolutely right. That we just have to trust that scientists will find some kind of a solution for that. But
yeah. Figure out the causes. Let's slip in one more poem. Do you have another from A Deed to the Light, or from any of your other books that you have in front of you?
Yeah, I have one more poem from A Deed to the Light, which is called, it's really a sound poem. It's called Geese, Tree, Apple, Leaves.
What's the last word?
The last word of the poem.
Of the title.
Of the title, Leaves.
L-E-A-V-E-S?
That's right,
got
Leaves.
It.
So it's about, it's these sound, the E sound, geese, tree, apple, leaves. And the epigraph says, every angel is terrifying, which is a line from Rainer Maria Rilke. Suppose you're blind, and so you can't see the broken necklace of geese sailing the sky. Then tilt up your face and listen as their honking riles the air. And if somehow you're going deaf as well, the cries of geese receding on the wind, then lay your hand on bark to feel the wind that sways the apple tree. Or if you can't feel the tree, then pick and eat one perfect apple. Or failing that, as rain gets out its knives, smell the fall, swift falling in the leaves. But oh, if all is growing dark, the darkness swallowing up the tree, its apples, leaves, and geese. And if you think a hawk is circling in the final autumn air, then let the splendid angel come, my friend, to read your rites to you. Quicksilver angel, angel of snow, the lover who has waited all your life at your elbow.
Jeannie Murray Walker reading her poem, Geese, Tree, Apple, Leaves, from her collection, A Deed to the Light, published by University of Illinois Press, and read by permission of the author and the press here on Keeping the Faith. I want to thank our author and playwright, Jeannie Murray Walker, for being our guest today by phone. I know it's not easy to hold a phone to an ear for a whole hour and to read with feeling and passion and sensitivity. So we do thank Jeannie for doing that. Thank
you. It's been a great pleasure, Steve. Thanks a lot.
Glad to have you. And her next book will be out this summer, published by Erdmans. Doesn't have a title yet, but about 70 or so of your poems that have been published in various journals, the Prairie Schooner, Shenandoah, Poetry, Image, Gettysburg Review, Kenyon Review. So we'll be looking forward to that collection coming out this summer. Again, Jeannie Murray Walker's name is spelled J-E-A-N-N-E-M-U-R-R-A-Y Walker, W-A-L-K-E-R. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith. Next week I'll be back here on the air with you and hope you'll give us a listen. Coming up this week on Thursday is a program at the Unitarian Church sponsored by the Intercultural Friendship Foundation. Thursday night at 7, that's 309 West Green Street, Sources of Faith, with a panel representing four or five different religious traditions. Also March 6th and also April 3rd will be two more programs in that series, Sharing One's Faith, The Problem of Evil, the Interreligious Dialogue Series. And at the Y this week, Tuesday at noon, a student veteran's call for peace in Iraq. And Friday at noon, Kathleen Robbins speaking on her experience in Haiti, talking about the Haitian economy and microfinance and technology being helpful in developing countries. Coming up next week here on Keeping the Faith, Claire Butterfield will be talking about faith in place and its way of dealing in an interfaith way with environmental concerns. The week following, Kaisi, YouTube Queen, talking about ethics and values and sexuality. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
When Ron Mallett's beloved father died, he wanted to bring him back, so he dreamed of building a time machine. Ron Mallett grew up to become a theoretical physicist, and he's still trying to figure out how to go back in time. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the physics of time travel. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana. A wind advisory is in effect for Champaign and surrounding counties until 8 o'clock tonight. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, light rain changing to light snow this evening, then a chance of light snow after midnight with little or no accumulation. The low in the mid-20s with west winds 20 to 25 miles per hour and gusting. Tomorrow, cloudy with scattered snow showers, much colder with the high in the upper 20s and west winds 15 to 20 miles per hour and gusting.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal; Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana; Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana; and First Federal Savings Bank, Champaign-Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great